Good afternoon again and welcome. My name is Ray Cunningham and I'm an associate of Greenhouse, which is the new think tank which is publishing, has published the report here which we are launching and discussing today, and I'm going to be chairing the proceedings. If I'm successful in this, it should look roughly as follows. First of all, the author of the report, Rupert Read, here on my right, will speak to or about the report for about 10 minutes. And then we will have brief comments from two people who contributed to the genesis of the report. I'll introduce them afterwards then. And then we'll have a round of comments and questions from everyone. And then, I'm pleased to say, we will have comments from three respected parliamentarians on political perspectives on the proposal, one of whom, John Cruddas, is here already. We're expecting Caroline Lucas and Norman Baker to join us shortly. Then there'll be a round of further discussion until we finish, hopefully around about 6:45, which might leave a little bit of time for mingling or for hand-to-hand combat or whatever. And we then need to clear the room by 7:00. So you should all have a copy of the report here on your seats or on your desks. It's also, sorry?
A few spares.
There are a few spares at the desk by the door, and it's also available to download from the Greenhouse website as of yesterday. There are also a couple of other earlier publications of Greenhouse which are on the desk there, display copies for you to browse through if you get a chance. So, as I've already mentioned, we're here to launch this paper. It is a knowingly provocative paper which makes a proposal for radical constitutional reform. As such, it has already generated a bit of advance interest in the media. In particular, there was a piece on the Guardian website by the environment editor, when was that, Friday, I think, which has already garnered over 300 comments. And Rupert has actually printed out not only the piece, but the 300 comments. So if any of you have a spare evening, then it's on the desk over there. There was also a piece on the Daily Telegraph website, on the blog of someone called Brendan O'Neill. Is he here by any chance? No, that's a bit of a shame because he might have contributed to a lively debate. I'll just quote from it briefly. The headline reads, "The Incredible Megalomania of the Green Party. Now they want to speak on behalf of the unborn." I'd make a quick correction here. This report has formally got nothing to do with the Green Party. The tenuous connection is that Caroline Lucas, as a member of the House here, is hosting the meeting and has facilitated our use of the room, but that's the end of it. But it starts then saying, "Having utterly failed to win over people in the here and now to their miserabilist agenda of humanity baiting and horizon shrinking, Greens are now claiming to represent a constituency that doesn't even exist yet, the unborn. They are cynically seeking to elevate the great unborn over the great unwashed, rallying non-existent people to their increasingly unpopular causes of austerity and misery in lieu of being able to marshal many existing people to such sad causes." So, Rupert, this is Rupert Read, the author of the report. He's a reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia, and he's also chair of Greenhouse. Is that a fair description of the report?
Okay, well, thanks, Ray. That's a great opening question. Thanks to you, thanks to everyone who's made today possible, including, of course, my colleagues in Greenhouse and in the Alliance for Future Generations, of which more anon. So yes, I'm going to provide a fairly brief introduction to the report that I've written. We'll then have a chance to discuss it, as you've heard. I really want to just situate the report in relation to the reasons for it, primarily, and give you an idea of my thinking processes that led into it, and then I think you'll see why I came up with the proposals that I did. So, what is the problem that this proposal is designed to address? Well, the first and simplest way of putting it is that we have to find some way of addressing the chronic short-termism of our political culture and of our economics. When we're thinking about things like the electoral cycle, let alone the news cycle, the economic cycle, quarterly reports, these are all kinds of things that incline people to incredibly short time horizons. So this idea is proposed to completely counterbalance those pressures towards short-termism. But there's another basis on which one can think about the basis for this report, for this proposal, and that's in the concept of democracy, and that's where I actually start out in the report. One of the main things I'm really wanting to do is to try to get people to reflect a little more on what we mean by democracy. What is democracy? And for me, the place to start with that is etymology, with the origins of the word. And democracy means, or is supposed to mean, the rule of the people, or the people governing. So the question we ought to ask ourselves is, do the people govern in Britain today? And to ask that question, I think, is pretty quickly to answer it. No, of course they don't. And that immediately suggests a whole raft of changes that probably many of us in this room are already signed up to, that are necessary. For example, a reformed electoral system, a thoroughly reformed upper house, slightly more radically, economic democracy, localization, participatory democracy. These are all the kinds of changes that would be needed to really make a country like Britain worthy of the name democratic, worthy of that word. But there's a problem that remains even after all of those reforms have perhaps been made in some wonderful future that we could imagine 10 years or so from now, perhaps. And that would be that there would be some very substantial constituencies left out of it. Because I want to say that we ought to think about what it means to have a people governing. In other words, who are the people who govern? Now, if the people are only the people who are alive today, if we're thinking of the people or of our society as consisting only of people who are alive today, then I think we're then again thinking in chronically short-termist ways. And we actually ought to think of the people as something which is stretched over this huge long temporal period, beginning in the past and going off indefinitely into the future. And it's the future people who matter the most, because of course there isn't a lot that we can do to harm people from the past. They've had their time, and while we should respect their memory and so on and so forth, we can't make their lives terrible or kill them before they're born or anything like that. But we can do that to future people. We can do those things to future people. And the grave danger is that we are doing those things to future people right now. So what I want to suggest is that we ought to find some way of including future people, future generations as yet unborn and born, in our democratic system. And that's the basis, as I see it, of this very radical proposal that I'm making. Now, how would we do that? So you've got to think about how you would have some kind of equivalent of allowing future people to be able to vote. Clearly, future people actually voting is no more possible than dogs voting. It's in fact even less possible, because you could give a dog a kind of whatever, you get the idea. So, we have to give people some kind of proxy equivalent of a vote. And by the way, think about it this way, I would urge you. As long as we don't do completely the wrong thing by future people and prevent them from existing at all, there will, over time, be a very great many more of them than there are of us. In other words, they would outvote us every time. So this equivalent of a proxy vote, I suggest, ought to be put in the form of a proxy veto. Right? If they got together, they would be able to outvote us every time. So a proxy veto to ensure the basic needs of future people. That's how I got to this concept. How are you going to instantiate that? Well, you need to have some group of people which are able to represent the needs, the basic interests of future people, and exercise that proxy veto. How are you going to select those people? Well, of course, you could elect them, but that would get into competition with our existing democratic institutions. And there's no particular reason for thinking that election is a good idea with regard to these representatives, because election is a way in which we, the present people, reflect our interests, desires, etc. And it's not a way in which future people are naturally, as it were, getting represented or having their views, basic needs, etc. expressed. We need to have some group of people who are designated as a group of people who are suitable for exercising this proxy veto. And my suggestion is that the only sane way to pick those people, rather than by election, is by random selection, by the same principle that animates the jury system. That is, of course, an intimate part of our democracy as we have it at the present time, insofar as we do have it. So that's the proposal, a super jury to reflect the basic needs and interests of future people, to be able to exercise a proxy veto on their behalf over legislation, to provide a test to ensure that whatever we do, whatever major steps we take in an institution such as this in which we are standing tonight, is future-proofed. And these people should be selected, as I say, like a jury, by random sortition, which, by the way, of course, was exactly the mechanism which was the main mechanism for democracy to work in Athens, which is well known as the birthplace of democracy. So there's no particular reason why democracy has to mean election. Democracy can mean random selection, sortition. It did in Athens, it could do again here and now, and it still animates our system through the jury system. So that's really it, that's my proposal. A super jury to represent the fundamental interests of future people, selected at random from any of us, so that nobody can say, oh, it's just those posh people, or it's just those people who have been appointed by the government, or it's just those people who are rich or well-connected enough to be elected, or anything like that. All of us, any of us, whether we're young, whether we're old, whether we're educated, whether we're not, are equally qualified and equally ill-qualified to be in this position of having to try to connect with what future people really need and start to put it into action. These people would have a period of training, they would have access to the very best of expertise to support them. Everybody, scientists, philosophers, activists, etc., would want to try to advise this super jury of the guardians for future generations. I think it could work. I've set out in the report in some detail how I think that. I'm also hoping, we're also hoping to open here a space for debate. This is not the kind of proposal that is going to be brought in tomorrow. Too often it seems to me, it seems to us at Greenhouse, think tanks spend a lot of their time thinking, how can we propose something which will be looked upon by this government or at most the next government as something which could plausibly be instituted. And that stops them too often from thinking visionary thoughts, from really trying to change the agenda, from really trying to open up the debate. That's very much what we're trying to do here. If a proposal like this was brought in by this government or the next government, great. But even if it isn't, the thing that we need to do right now, it seems to us, is urgently to open up the terrain of this kind of debate. So this is intended not just to be a proposal that will be brought in, but also a proposal to open people's minds and to spark a debate. Looking by the pages of The Guardian and The Telegraph, it's already done that, and I hope to have more of it this evening. Thanks for your time, and let's get the debate started.
Thanks very much. If you're already on fire with questions, then hold on for a couple more minutes. We've asked two people to make brief commentaries on the paper, both of whom have contributed in different ways to its getting to where it is today. First is Nicolo Voyevoda from the Alliance for Future Generations, and after him, Peter Roderick will speak. He's the author of a report called Taking the Longer View, which Rupert drew on in writing his own report. So Nicola, first, please.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to say a few words about the Alliance for Future Generations, which comes actually very easy, because Dr. Reed's paper has in its roots the same roots that are behind the Alliance for Future Generations, which is, on one hand, the concern that there's a real risk of short-termism in current UK policy processes and democracy, and that undermines the needs of future generations. And this despite the fact that, as a recent Ipsos Mori poll proved or supported, people, ordinary citizens, do care about leaving a better world behind. So in this case, governments and structures are lacking behind more than people's sentiments. And on the other hand, the other core tenet of the Alliance work is that there's a hope and conviction that there are alternatives to overcome those risks. There are alternatives, and they need to be brought to life, just like in this debate tonight. That's how the Alliance started its work in March 2011 and grew to more than 40 members between organizations and individuals. Under the leadership of a lot of individuals and organizations, but mostly Helena, the Foundation for Democracy and Sustainable Development, and the Alliance that includes as its members also Dr. Reed and Karen Lucas. And it's really grown into a place for both debate, as exemplified by the event tonight, but also collaboration. One of the things that the Alliance has been working on lately is a Notes and Challenge paper that was submitted to the Reinforce 20 consultation. And perhaps as a sign that these issues are starting to see some resonance in the international community is that in the recent zero draft of the Reinforce 20 summit, of the UN Conference for Sustainable Development that's happening in the summer, there is indeed a mention of an ombudsperson for future generations. So signs like these are very positive and welcome evidence that discussions like these are even more important. Especially considering how the mission of the Alliance included the proposal to have a High Commissioner for Future Generations, which had this proposal and many others. So on a personal level, I can only say that I think that the Alliance should put forth more food for thought, just like Rupert's discussion paper tonight, and I'm looking forward to the discussion tonight.
Thank you, Nicola. Peter.
Okay. I've got a message here from Sándor Filip, who is the man elected by the Hungarian Parliament to be the Commissioner for Future Generations. And I'll read out just the beginning and the ending of that. And people are welcome to read it afterwards. It says, "It is my regret that I cannot take part in this event because of organizational and financial reasons. My heart is with you, and I fully support the idea developed by Mr. Reed about the Guardians for Future Generations. The Hungarian Ombudsman for Future Generations, the New Zealand Environmental Parliamentary Commissioner, the Israeli and the Finnish Parliamentary Commissions for Future Generations, the New Jersey Chief Environmental Prosecutor, the Austrian and Canadian Regional National Environmental Ombudspersons, similar organizations planned in Wales and Malta, were, are, and will be good examples for institutional solutions that seem to spread out in the world. Even more important, if they could get a global counterpart, a guardian or high representative for future generations somewhere in the organizational structure of the United Nations and also some of the regional administrations such as the EU. I'm convinced that we shall keep fighting for more such institutional innovations in the name of intergenerational justice and also in the name of our present constitutional values and the basic human sense and interests. Our ancestors were able to live in peace with nature and with their past and future generations. We have to learn it again and to recreate these functions and institutions that serve our survival. This is our only chance. We should not miss it." And I must say I'm very pleased to have been involved with Rupert in the development of his paper from the legal point of view and the constitutional law point of view. And when he first mentioned the idea to me, after falling off my chair and spluttering my samosa across the table, I slowly kind of he's kind of slowly won me over to the idea, as I would formulate it, of having people based in the legislature who have to take the longer view. I remain to be convinced totally by the argumentation on the grounds of representation, because I think it is about how we here and now behave, how our minds work, what our values are, how we make decisions. We don't need as it were, to have the concept of representation. I think it's about us and our behaviour. I'm also slightly, not totally won over by the idea of a veto. I think when it's put in terms of a veto, the idea that there will be people placed in the legislature who can say no, that sounds rather strong. But then when you think about it as well, until we have the Parliament Act, until we have a House of Lords vested in the land, who didn't like Lloyd George's land reform plans, that was we used to have a veto, effectively. We needed both Houses of Parliament to say yes. And then the Parliament Act came in, and then we tend to think, ah yes, of course, the House of Commons is supreme. So I'm not totally opposed to the idea of a veto. I think it'd be very interesting to hear from comparative constitutional lawyers, for example, and how other legislatures work. But I think there's lots of very interesting things there. But I think basically, Rupert, I think you've done a great service to us in kicking off this kind of discussion. And it seems to be unanswerable that the long-term interest has to be put into our system, and we have to find the best way we can to represent that systematically within the lawmaking process. And this is a great start to that discussion. So thank you.
Thank you, Peter. I think it's a nice arc within Rupert's report that it draws not only on ancient Athenian democracy, but on one of the younger Eastern European democracies and their experience as well, as we heard in the letter there. So, over to you for questions and comments. Can I get an indication first of how many people it's core to begin with? Okay, you were first.
Hi, I'm Joe from campaign to make eco-cyber crime, make mass disruption of the environment of crime for both ourselves and the future generation.
Can I just thank you for telling us who you are, because yes. I forgot to ask if you could all do that in case we can follow up afterwards. Thanks very much.
Of course. I guess when we're thinking of future generations, there's something that's inherently, you use the word visionary in your introduction, something creative and visionary. And I've only had a brief place through the report so far, but the emphasis seems to be more on the research and blocking out, which seems important. But I wonder how we really, if we believe this argument, how do we really take this to conclusions where we have systematically systems and people in place who can really be that creative force for creating a visionary new legislation and ideas for the future generations. And I guess a follow on from that, maybe to the politicians and the speakers, should we take this further? Should there be a cabinet post or a minister for future generations?
Shall I take
Thank
that?
Thank you. Do you want to say that straight
yep.
away?
Yeah, that's a great question. The short answer is that there is some stuff in the report that addresses this. I think that it is important that the Guardians are not seen as being only negative in the way that they operate. So I suggest that they could be given the power, either individually or collectively or in small groups. These kinds of details could be worked out, obviously, much later, to initiate legislation. And this would be a positive thing. They could also be given the power, which is a power which, roughly speaking, the Hungarian Ombudsman has, to undertake large-scale processes of research and things like that that could be directed towards the needs of future generations. So those would be a couple of examples. But basically, I absolutely agree with you.
So there were two questions. Oh, it's growing already. I think the woman there, you were next. Yeah, in the second row from the back.
So I think it's important to talk about future peoples, we are thinking about today's children. I mean, some of the world's developing, which is over 50% of the population, they don't get snow. So, yeah, that's.
Yeah, that's a lovely question. Thank you. There are different ways one can go with this. One could make the remit of the Guardians restricted to unborn future generations. I would actually prefer to have it be to do with all future people. And that actually means everybody. But some of us are not going to be future people for as long as others. Namely, for example, the older people in the room, unfortunately. This comes to us all. So this would mean that that when you're thinking, for example, about the year 2100, that seems a reasonable year to be thinking about in terms of future people, in terms of future generations. Well, of course, there are already people who are alive today who are going to be still around in 2100. So I think that in that way, we should have a kind of idea that the younger somebody is, the closer they are to being, if you like, a full-scale future person. Another dimension of this to do with children, which is interesting, is that one might think quite creatively about how young the Guardians can be. Now, I haven't put this in the report because this is incredibly controversial. I've kind of assumed in the report that the youngest they would be is 18. But why should we necessarily take that for granted? For example, it's an extremely striking fact that in Britain today, the age of criminal responsibility is 10. Well, if you're old enough to be criminally responsible for things, and you can go to prison, basically, and so on and so forth, are we sure that you're not old enough to exercise some sort of responsible, visionary role in a process like this? In other words, what I'm getting at is it clear that it would be a mistake to enable some people who are not even 18 to be guardians? And I'm not sure it's at all clear. I think that's, again, something which would be really interesting to debate and think about.
It strikes me there's an interesting point there, which is like almost the reverse of economic discounting, isn't it? I mean, we normally discount downwards the further we go in the future. You could almost argue that future generations, the further away they are from us, you have to discount upwards.
Yes, well, I wouldn't go too far on that front. I think that the people who are alive in 10 million years' time, let's hope there are some, I think they're going to mostly have to take care of themselves. I think what we should be worried about is what we can foresee as being potential harms to future people. So one very obvious example would be something like nuclear power. So when you're talking about a form of power that produces poisonous waste that lasts for hundreds of thousands of years, that, it seems to me, is one of a clear example of an issue which is pretty ill-served by our current political institutions. And as Peter was saying, it would be great to have a place in those political institutions where there were people who were required and empowered to take a longer view. I rather suspect that they would take a dim view of nuclear power.
Okay, I think that the earliest question was also in the row next to the last woman there. Yeah, that's you.
Thank you very much. I'm Alex Wardyak. I'm a political scientist at the University of Surrey. And I'd like to ask a question about the joined-up nature of governance and how you see your proposal for super juries to represent future generations to fit in with the context in which political power actually operates. I saw, just looking at your report, that you talked a little about multi-level governance in a way looking at the local level. There's some very interesting thoughts there about connecting up local and national. But what about connecting up with international issues and international structures? For example, what would you do if, for example, in Westminster, your committee was formed and decided that something should be done in the interest of future generations, and yet you had a contrary vote to say European level? Or vice versa, what would you do if in the European Parliament were there to be a suitable and similar committee set up and they decided something was against the interest of future generations, and yet a British committee or a German committee or even a Scottish committee in the future perhaps decided that it wasn't? What mechanisms would you have for trying to reconcile the decisions that such juries would make when the competence or the legal competence for those decisions isn't wholly within national impact?
Yeah. Well, so partly this comes to what Nicola was talking about, right? It's implicit in my report that there's no particular reason to think that there should only be some kind of guardian-like institutions at national level, but also, as you said, at local level and at international level, and maybe we're starting to move in that direction. Your question is very interesting, Alex, although I think to some extent it's not a question that I have to answer, in the sense that to some extent it's simply a question of, well, what do you do when you get conflicts between different levels of power? And that's a kind of question for anyone interested in political institutions or constitutional matters. I would just highlight one thing in particular, which I do address in the report, which we had a long and fascinating debate about within the Alliance for Future Generations, which is, what about the Human Rights Act and the European Court of Human Rights? And basically the way I've come down on that, which I think is satisfactory, is that there should be a right of appeal from the Guardians to the European Court of Human Rights. But there should also be reform of the European Court of Human Rights, such that they include taking future generations seriously within their remit as well, which at present they basically don't. And there is some movement apparently in that direction. I think that movement has to be continued. It wouldn't be any good, it seems to me, to have the European Court be able to veto the Guardians if the European Court is not open to considering the basic interests and needs of the future generations to come.
The questions are multiplying. We are going to have comments shortly from at least two parliamentarians, hopefully three. So if your question is on, as it were, the political practicality or political reactions to these proposals, perhaps you'd like to save that, because we'll have another longer round after that. Have I succeeded in weeding that down to a manageable number?
Almost.
Okay, well, I suggest I take the first four I saw. Two. Three. There's a good compromise. And I think that's the gentleman in the back row, the lady in the second from back row, and the guy in the corner. Yeah, can we have those questions together, and then we'll try and have a brief round up. So, you were first.
My name is Jim Chong. I'm a member of the Alliance for Future Generations, and part of the four future generations of the Green Party. What I would like to ask today is that in terms of the where we are now and what we have done with the future generations. Because the language should not really be about us creating the future for future generations, but as a matter for restitution for the damage that we have already done, and actually to change the language from one of the elders giving to the future generations, but for us as the elders trying to correct damage that we have already done, because it is actually a case of intergenerational oppression in the same way that the imperialistic powers of old enslaved the developing countries.
Okay, and the next was, yes, please.
Okay, I'm Natalie Strickland, I'm from an organisation called Wildlife UK, and we promote advocate earth-centred governance or eco-centric governance. I'm also a member of the Occupy London Environment Working Group, speaking about capital. As we've got from Marshall, I think what you put forward is a very important contribution to the debate, but by each generation you just include people, that's too narrow, because we co-evolved with millions of other species over millennia. And I believe that they have a major legal voice in our democracy, and I wonder if you have thought about the other species.
Thank you. In the far corner.
My name is James Lowry, I write about ethics and climate change. I just have a very happy suggestion for you. Not a question, really. I like what you did when you sort of argued that given our democracy means we're already committed to the notion that we have to look after future people. I like that. Think about how this notion is going to be expanded in the world. It occurred to me that my American brothers and sisters are similarly committed in the preamble of the Constitution of that mind of the people of the United States.
It's in one of the footnotes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Fantastic. If you haven't read the footnotes, I'll. It says to me, gives us the liberty of ourselves and our posterity.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it seems like we're writing the Constitution, built the association, that might be something to usefully exploit.
Thanks, James. Yeah, totally agree. On the other two questions, the enslavement point, Chit, well, as you can tell from the title of the Guardian piece, if you've seen that, I basically agree. I think we have to be clear about just how bad we are at risk of making things for future people, and I think enslavement is a good analogy, a provocative one, but a good one, because to enslave people is to force them to work really hard for your benefit or at your behest. And that is what is in danger of happening to future people. They may be forced really hard to work really hard just to survive. And finally, on the question about nature and non-human animals, I do very briefly address this in the report. I completely agree that we should, that the other great class, if you like, of voiceless beings that deserve some kind of place in our democratic thinking are non-human animals. In terms of nature and ecosystems, my own view, this is an interesting debate we could have, my own view is that the best way to think about their place in our system is as absolutely essential preconditions for the well-being of non-human animals and of human animals, i.e. us. And in that sense, it seems to me that taking future people seriously necessitates taking ecosystems seriously. There's no way of avoiding that. But I rather suspect that actually the best way to get people to take ecosystems seriously is going to be through getting them first, at least, to take future people seriously. So that's the sort of strategic impulse, if you like, behind, if you like, the order of priority which I'm taking things here. But thank you so much for the question. We could discuss it more.
Okay, thanks very much. I should add that Rupert is an academic, so there's a hell of a lot of footnotes there.
There were a lot more before you made me edit it.
I'd like at this point then to ask the three UK parliamentarians who've kindly agreed to come along to give brief comments, and after that we'll move to another round, so there are lots of questions already. First, because she got us in the room, it's Caroline Lucas. Second, because he got here from the start, is John Cruddas. And third, I'm pleased to say Norman Baker is now also here. Caroline.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to say a few words and to share some thoughts around the publication of Rupert's report. And I hope very much that it will stimulate a much-needed debate on an idea that needs to be discussed not just in these forums, but much, much more widely. And that idea, of course, is essentially around how we challenge the short-termism of the current political system and how we work out a way of incorporating a long-term perspective into all the decisions that we make. And I think in an era of focus group obsession, it's about how we think about the impact of policy, not just 5 weeks hence or 5 months hence, but 50 years hence and 500 years hence. And I think it is important that we discuss it thoroughly and seriously, because governing with future generations in mind is a huge part of what it means to be green, I think. But in some ways, if I can risk being a bit controversial, it can also appear to contradict everything that I hold dear as a progressive, as a radical, as a believer in democracy. And so I think it's quite tricky, the kind of challenge that this debate poses for us, that governing on behalf of future generations puts two of the most fundamental democratic ideals, in some sense, in contradiction with one another. And I'll try to explain what I mean. Rupert has quoted Edmund Burke at the opening of the report, saying, "Society is a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living, those who are dead, those who are yet to be born." And of course, governments of every colour become accustomed to simply fighting fires and not doing what Edmund Burke suggests, but simply doing whatever is necessary to keep voters on their side by the time the next election rolls around. For parliamentarians today, the present is what matters, and if that means making life difficult for future generations, then that's essentially their problem. And of course, we do in the present do a lot of clearing up of messes left by the last lot. Yet it's increasingly clear, I think, that we can't carry on thinking like that. The actions of the dead, the living, and the as-yet-unborn are all connected, and unless we kick the habit of leaving messes around for the next generation to clear up, then I think the planet and our descendants will face untold suffering. But having said that, I think it's also worth remembering that to some extent Burke was speaking as an arch-conservative. He was speaking in defence of tradition, of stability, of the status quo. He was seeking to demolish the kind of radical revolutionary democratic ideals of liberty and self-determination that we've come to cherish. Thomas Paine, that great champion of democracy and freedom, responded to Burke's conservatism by saying, "The vanity and presumption of governing beyond the grave is the most ridiculous incident of all time." It's something not quite as talented as it was said by the Telegraph. And there will be many of those who at first glance will see this proposal that we govern with the needs of future generations in mind as anathema to our fundamental democratic instincts, a sort of governing beyond the grave in reverse. Why should we prioritise the needs of future generations ahead of those of the current generation, and dare we presume to shape the world our descendants will live in? Don't we trust them to take care of their own needs the way we have to take care of ours? And isn't this future people stuff just another attempt on the part of eco-fascists to tell us what to do? Now, I wouldn't use that language, but I do have a few concerns, I have to say, about the Guardians as an answer. Some of the concerns have already been raised in the room. But I do think that the question which Rupert and his colleagues are seeking to ask is absolutely crucial. And the publication of this report is absolutely vital to the process of how we answer it. So whether or not we think the Guardians is an answer, whether or not we think an ombudsperson is the answer, whether or not we think that modifying things like European the Declaration of Human Rights is the answer, I think all of those are still up for grabs and part of the debate. And I think that by putting his views on the table so clearly and eloquently, I think it forces us to think, well, if it's not that, for those of us who think, well, it's not that, then what is it? And I think that debate is a really, really important one to be had. Because, of course, the truth is that we already shape the world of our descendants in all sorts of malign, short-sighted and self-interested ways. We do it every time we dump nuclear waste, and we do it every time we raise a forest or make room for a motorway or tear up planning regulations for the sake of short-term economic growth. And it's that kind of governing beyond the grave that really is the most ridiculous instrument of all tyrannies. And I just leave you with the thought that, of course, there is an alternative form of governing beyond the grave. You've felt the benefit of it every time you've sat in a park under the shade of a mature oak or walked down an avenue of broad-leafed limes. The people who planted those trees did so in the knowledge that they would never live to enjoy them fully grown, but they planted them anyway because they knew that someday someone else would enjoy them. I think if you think of the gratitude you feel for such far-sighted, selfless people, the challenge is for ourselves to become such people. And I think we must give the people of the future something to be grateful to us for. And so I want to thank Rupert again for stimulating this debate. I think it's an absolutely vitally important one. It's needed more than ever before as I sit here in a parliament which shocks me on a daily basis by the incredibly short-termism of its thinking. If we had a bit more of this kind of thinking inserted into our processes, I think it would be a very good thing indeed.
John. Thanks, Ray. Well, I'll be very brief, partly because I'm here to listen, actually, because I find the report slightly uncomfortable, which is good, and sort of counterintuitive in a way as a politician. I was just listening to what Caroline said. I echo very much what she was saying. But when she talked about tradition, I started thinking about sitting in here, in the epicentre of so many British traditions. It brought back the sort of phrase used by Chesterton to talk about tradition as the democracy of the dead. And what is the opposite to that? And it seems to me that's what you're trying to grapple with in terms of the generational obligations. And I go back to that quote you recited at the beginning around the Telegraph, actually, in that the immediate response is because this generation is doing everything so well that it doesn't need to confront some of the questions of the almost epochal generational transfers that are going on in real time today. And that's why this is such a challenging but vital contribution. It goes back to the short-termism, obviously economically, obviously ecologically, but also culturally, I think, in terms of patterns of consumption of news and everything being disposable and the shrinking of the time horizons that we're all living within. And you need correctives to try and unwind that. And that's what I think this report does. That's why I sort of commend it as a really sort of incendiary proposition, really. I quite like the idea that it confronts the inverse relationship between the scale of the crisis and the remedies at hand, you know, because we do not seem to be awash with significant, profound interventions in terms of policy remedies across the front, really. And that's not meant as a political thing. I think that's a generic critique of the modern politic because of the short-termism, the parliamentary cycles that everyone operates within, the news cycles, etc., etc. So I think it's good, because it's a big idea, and we're not awash with them. So all power to your elbow. I do think it fits into quite an interesting broader perspective around electoral reform, reintroducing people into this conversation politically, how you do it, given that the stakes are so high. I had some questions in terms of the specifics, in terms of the juries and patterns of recall and contest and the like, and whether an ombudsman is better, and how we can learn from comparative experiences, be they in Hungary or Israel or Bolivia or whatever, or what's going on. But I do think it, because it shakes you as a proposition, it's interesting, so therefore I'm sort of drawn to it. And I have this thing, you talk about Thomas Paine, it's brilliant. I just finished John Keats' biography of Thomas Paine. The colleague in the corner was talking about the American Constitution. He, of course, is a great friend of Thomas Jefferson. And you do think that these great pioneers of the 18th century actually would have had the capacity to consume big ideas, gestate, and come up with their own responses. And that says something about the shrinkage of the political franchise and the ideas. And our collective memories, actually, and our capacity to come up with new remedies. And this is precisely what's needed. Whether, in fact, you agree with it singularly, or parts of it, or whatever, that's not really the point. The point is to contest space, to put things in, to percolate in the mix, and actually to return in a few years' time and see what effect it has. So all power to your elbow. I think it's a really interesting intervention. I return to my slight discomfort at this. The questions it raises, but that's good. And I think we should give it as a wider and a deeper area as we can to try and sort of see it can be part. We should have hundreds of these sorts of ideas rather than just one or two that we seek to nurture. So good luck to you. And I congratulate the think tank itself as well as Rupert. I think it's a really timely intervention. And I'm listening and learning as we go on.
Thanks, John.
Well, first of all, could I say I'm sorry I wasn't here for 50. I'm sorry to hear the last bit either, because there's things going on with going to do with high speed rail and everything else. But I want to come along because this is an important issue. It's an issue which has bothered me sometimes, the question of the environment, take the Brundtland approach, the environment we pass on to future generations, should be better or as good as the one we inherited. That seems to me to be absolutely the right approach to life. Now, we didn't hear the Edinburgh quote, the associated group on Brundtland with Edinburgh until this evening, so that's a novel association I've raised with myself tonight. And that is a very important question, and like Caroline, I share the concern about short-termism in politics. There's always worried me that, and there's always a tension between the democratic deficit, if you like, the democratic need to ensure people are regularly held to account for what they do. And Thomas Paine had plenty to say about that. Who elected you? How do we agree with you? I think it was two questions he asked. And I'd like to see, by the way, that the Southern Village has migrated to Dagger and Andy across the front from the Andy, definitely the people I said, where he was born, and I have to say, what Thomas Paine said 200 years ago, developed today. As it was then, was the two marks, somebody who's very well focused. The short-term politics means that sometimes people say we can't afford to cut the ground, we've got to make sure we've got jobs tomorrow. That's absolutely the wrong approach. Absolutely the wrong approach. And those who say, I'm talking in slightly bleak language, then we need to think about the environment or downplay the environment because the economy are absolutely wrong. They're absolutely wrong morally, but they're absolutely wrong in their long term as much as anything else because the economy of the future depends on us providing a stable, sustainable planet. And that means actually minimising our ground footprint whilst trying not to sacrifice our living standards. That's what we've got to try and do. So, how do we get to this ideal that Bruegel set out, and then Bert set out, and a group of questions set out for us tonight in his interesting approach? And how do we contrast that with the majority view in the country, say, and the short-termism of politics. And it is the majority view in the country, and I'm not highbound by voting with anyone in the else, but I have to say, look at the stats. So when you ask people are interested in, and those questions speaking, when they're asked usually, the environment comes way, way out of what people have decided, a lot of people have decided, the environment is an extra, and what we're solving at the economy, we can't afford to have the environment. I totally reject that argument, but I have to say that is a view which is widely held, not just in this place, but out there in the country. And therefore, I suspect that it's probably for good and true. They wouldn't necessarily come up with the answers which we would like to come up with in terms of how they might approach the priorities. We don't necessarily agree with the group, to use your phrase, but nevertheless, that is what we come up with. And even if you had people, good and true, who did share my view, and not view of many too, I'm sure, about having the environment protected for generations in the same position as it is now, there are different political issues. I mean, how should we agree on the issues today? What's the conclusion on that? I happen to think that environmentally is in the plus. But there are others who would argue to say, well, you're freeing up slots at least for a natural long-term plus, everything else. So not entirely black and white on a major issue like that. And that requires a deep level of analysis, which is a lot to ask a small group of people picked at random to conclude. There are issues of due which are about fraud cases and whether or not they're able to got the time to absorb hugely complex issues for one case. If you're asking people to look at all the gathers of policies far and wide, that's a lot to ask for. That's not to downplay the idea that it is very interesting, but it's just to say, how can we perhaps, that on balance, how can we achieve what we want to achieve? And is there other ways of doing it? Democracy, the church, or the rest of the government, apart from all others, there's some truth in that. And whatever the faults of this place, and they are many and varied, I can say to a person that what was the truth in 97 when I arrived, people were wanting to have a top hats in the division there, when the division opened, and we moved on from that, fortunately, not very much, not far enough. But at least people in this place are elected, all going through an inadequate voting system, an unfair voting system that doesn't give full weight to different strands of opinion, which is far from the same seat to individual parties up and down the country, where one has is unelected still, and I remember saying to someone last week in a TV debate, they must get on their national form, and I was accused of hurrying me up too far. Well, that would be 500 years if I had been left. So I'm really hurrying it up too much. We've got to sort out these constitutional problems, because actually, getting the constitutional issues right are the foundations for a good democracy, which involves people properly in a way that presently doesn't occur. That includes access to laws, includes electoral reform, includes extension to my view, freedom of information. So I look at what the democratic system can produce for communities. I look at things like the Climate Change Act, that could be a good example of what you can plan for the future. Where there are targets, governments of the future are being held to, was the requirement for all departments with regard to state what's happening. That was a cross-party effort that had to be in the Devon Project of the Labour Editorial Committee as well to take that all department. And that was largely done with cross-party cooperation. When we look at what the position is in other countries where people deny climate change still, or if they advocate action, they're a minority. We've got the establishment, if you like, in this country, signed up to what the content of climate change. And they take action, and that's a major achievement for this country. So that's one way with the directory system that seems to be incredible. The Environment Law Committee, which I used to sit on, is another example of a cross-cutting arrangement with democratic accountability and sub-boomf, which has got the capacity to hold government certainly beyond that and industry and others to account. We look at international obligations, enforceable ones, like the Kyoto Treaty and Brooklyn Law might come as a smaller one to that. So these aren't perfect solutions, but I'm quite clear that they have got democratic legitimacy of some sort. And I think that we're going to be able to make progress. We have to have that democratic legitimacy in order to persuade people that this is where we are going. So I want to explore those avenues and see how those might be further improved. And excuse me if I have to go before very long.
On that very point, thank you very much. I know you have to head off shortly. I know Rupert wanted to respond directly to a couple of your points. Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, just
you may not get another reply.
Yeah, just very quickly, thanks so much to Caroline and John. I'll just let their remarks stand, which is very quickly on two points that Norman has raised there. One, the point about people say the economy is more important than the environment, that comes back, I think, to the question we had before about nature and ecosystems and our children and our children's children. Part of what I'm trying to suggest is if we actually find a way, and I think this might be part of the way, to get people to think about what their children's children and their children's children's children, future people, need, then we might start to change that. We might start to get people to think, well, actually, the economy isn't more important if it means that my grandchildren are going to be stuffed. And the second point, very quickly, is you're of course absolutely right that we can't know that the super jury would make what some of us in this room would think of as the right decisions. And that, of course, is the gamble that one always takes with any democratic mechanism. And I want to suggest that a super jury where people could think, that actually might be me, and some of the people on that are like me, whereas actually, of course, parliamentarians tend to come from an extremely restricted proportion of the population, both especially age-wise, for example. Virtually all parliamentarians are between about 35 and 65 now. There are virtually none who are very young or very old, as people on the super jury could be. I actually think that if we said, this could be you, and if you were trained and expertly advised, and if you took an oath to do your best to make things okay for the basic needs of future generations, I actually think that's as good as hope as we may have for something which would be enough to do that. But let's carry on talking about it.
Okay, can I say, and Norman has to leave shortly, take this point to say thank you very much to the three parliamentarians for extremely valuable... Right, there were already quite a few indications of people wanting to speak. Can I see roughly how many we have? Right, we've got 15 to 20 minutes. So can I take Mayor first?
Thank you. I just want to firstly congratulate everybody who's been involved in getting this subject onto the political and hopefully the public agenda. Now, many of us have been writing about it for many years ago, totally failed. So it's a joy to hear a meeting in this way talking on such issues. It seems to me that what Rupert's report does is to open, I don't know whether it's a hornet's box or a Pandora's, a hornet's nest or a Pandora's box. And I just start two aspects of it. The first one is related to the finite nature of the atmosphere to absorb the burning of fossil fuels and include the finite nature of mineral reserves. If one takes into account the claims of future generations, and hopefully we need to think about future generations as being an infinite number, then there is no doubt at all that to share this out, actually, the claims of future generations on those finite situations means that we have got to go for zero emissions, or as close to zero emissions as there's good at zero emissions, both from the burning of fossil fuels and from the using of fossil fuels. And the last thing we need to be doing is to be seeking to extract more fossil fuels as the major oil and gas companies are attempting to do, because to burn those is going to make the situation even worse for future generations. And once one factors those in, then it altogether, hopefully, I'm sorry Norman Baker's lost, but I mean the proposition of a 90% reduction of emissions by 2050 is an adequate answer to this finite nature of the sharing out of that with future generations. So that's one point that I think needs the subject of considerable debate, not appropriate in a situation where the chairman is thinking, I don't want to talk too long and there's a limited time to do so. But the other point I wanted to make was in relation to Rupert's proposition on the representation of spokespersons. Yes, representation of spokespersons in the way that it is set up, if I understand it correctly, it would be, a UK jury? Well, if it's a UK jury, but these are issues affecting populations of third world far more than the populations of first world like ours. And from that perspective, you know, it's almost an imperialistic judgment that we in the West know far better how to consider the claims of future generations in the third world that perspective, I would far rather see people of, let's say, the Mandela class, so to speak, selected because they are voted into the best people that we can, that the world can think of as representing the future.
Well, let me let me respond to that. Of course, the first problem with that proposal, Mayor, is that you don't know who people would vote in. Maybe they would vote in Mandela, or maybe they would vote in Clarkson. And that's one of the reasons why.
That's why democracy would question in this instance, because it's quite likely that people will not be prepared to accept a future that is in which they're obliged to live on zero carbon.
Yeah, well, that may be true. I think that the best prospects we have as a democracy for doing what needs to be done, which you're absolutely right about, is something like what I'm talking about. I think this kind of idea where people think, well, I could be one of those guardians, my name could be picked out of the hat, might actually be the kind of thing that could create buy-in where you wouldn't get it for something like an ombudsman or a constitutional entrenchment. To come back to your previous point, which is of course related, I've worded this report for something like the UK, but I have specifically said in the report, as we discussed briefly, very briefly earlier, that these guardians or something like them should also operate on a local level and should also operate on an international level, and we come back again to what Niccolo said in that general or vague direction. One reason for thinking that guardians at the UK level would, without being imperialistic, would actually think about questions on a more global basis, which I think would be a good thing, than many of our current parliamentarians do, is the following. If you're actually serious about taking care of people in the UK on a long-term basis, if you're thinking about people in the UK in 200 years from now, then you have to think about global threats seriously. Because basically, as we know, environmental problems don't respect national frontiers. The further you go into the future, the more likely it is that something that happens in another country is going to adversely affect people in this country. So I think willy-nilly, the guardians would actually have to consider global threats more seriously than our current politicians do. And I take that to be an advantage of the proposal.
Okay. Gentleman there in the stand, you're right. That's you.
Angus Canton of the New Generations Foundation. I just want to challenge what Norman Baker was saying about what the public think. We did a joint project between the Alliance of Future Generations and the New Generations Foundation where we said, well, let's actually go out there and ask what people think. So we put together some questions which were professionally asked, which is basically 2 or 3 months ago, giving it to us more involved. To ask people what they thought were actually future generations were. And it turned out, perhaps surprisingly, certainly encouraging, that two-thirds of people we asked, we were asked over 600,000 people randomly selected, two-thirds of them thought that government gives too little priority to future generations. And when they were asked to list what they thought was important, they put the environment handing on a sound environment to their children and grandchildren, they put that as a significantly higher priority, very much higher priority, than handing on a thriving economy. So I think you're wrong. I don't know if you've listened to Daily Mail surveys, but we chose a scientific method by an independent party, and we think this way the general public are actually running ahead of the politicians, and we hope the politicians will do more than
gentleman at the back, with the other paper, that's you. Yeah. Yeah.
Just a quick question of the juries as well, Naomi Truly, something about his decisions. If you look at the Greenpeace Kingsmill case and quite a few preceding cases, what you do in that is that when people aren't being horribly propagandized about key vote issues, even when presented with quite complex information, do actually time and again make very sensible decisions. The question of information politics goes around all these kind of questions very significantly. And for instance, you could say maybe to have older statesmen trying to be more respected, instead of a jury, we create more sort of political cultural capital, maybe that would be useful to counteract propagandistic forces. But then if you were to elect them, then you would subject that process to the same complexity forces by the media. If you allow the government to appoint them, then they would not appoint sufficiently people who would go against the interests of power. So I think wherever you turn the world at the moment, the elephant in the room, one of the elephants in the room, is information politics. It's who pays for and controls the information that gets to the people. And that is what constrains political options so much, and leads to a situation where the average person seems to be behaving as somebody that doesn't care, because they're just responding to basic consumerist drives. But actually, if you ask them what they think, they do want policies that don't support consumers, and they do care about things. They're just not empowered to do narratives that help them take steps forward for that. That's some of the answers to the problem.
Okay, thank you very much. And the woman next to you?
Claire Morris, I'm a renewable energy researcher and a climate activist. I really struggle with your report just from the perspective of a young person. I just come back from Durban where I was representing and participating in the youth presence there, and actually the youth constituency has only just been recognised and fully inflated as a constituency within the UN process, and our voice and opinions are still not being heard at all. And for you to be saying that we should be listening to people who aren't born, when the youth already here, who are probably some of the most literary people in our society, are not fully being heard yet, I think it's difficult for me. Although I do recognise that we're opening a very challenging phase here, and perhaps that's this sort of thinking is what's going to take it forward. But I think there's a lot more we can do to young people, and certainly I would recommend perhaps that this is a section of society that needs to be more represented within the guidance of the future, since the current parliamentary representation, as you said, is 35 to 65.
Yeah. Just very briefly to reiterate what I did already say on this, my preferred definition of future people would include everyone who is alive, and that would mean that the youth were actually at the forefront of that, because they are going to be future people for longer than people who are older. And also, crucially, people who are 18, 25, whatever, could be guardians, where virtually none are parliamentarians at the moment, and maybe even younger than 18. So basically, I totally agree with you, but I think my proposal is really pushing at an open door in the direction you want to go in. I don't think it's a problem for you at all. I hope you'll be able to see it positively in that way.
Sorry, he's put his hand down now. Didn't you have your hand up before?
I did.
Has that gone?
I can ask the question, yes. Recent graduate, future person, if you like. I'm sharing enthusiasm, as I'm sure other people in this room do. But how do you see this as actually becoming embedded into public consciousness? Because all the ideas of grounded are very unpopular. You've got issues of morality, climate change, stuff people don't want to hear, people don't want to talk about. Picking up on people's and people say they respond positively to questioning about the future. The fact is, people voice opinions to appear more realistic in surveys, there's more reports, that kind of stuff. So when you actually break this down, how do you see it?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great, really important question. It's obviously a massive question. The first thing I would say in response to it is that all of you, everyone here tonight, can play their role in taking this forward by, for example, going away and talking to people about it, tweeting about it, putting it on Facebook, blogging about it, writing letters to the paper, getting involved with Greenhouse or the Alliance, whatever it might be. There's loads of ways in which anyone here can take responsibility for taking this forward. As was sort of present in John's remarks earlier, this is, and as I said myself in my remarks at the start, I'm not suggesting this thinking that any party is likely to say, oh, well, yeah, okay, we'll put that straight in our manifesto for the next election. It's more a question of getting everybody to think about moving in this kind of direction. You're absolutely right, people don't want to, but they also do want to. right? People are in denial in all sorts of ways about this, but they also really care about it. And a lot of people are actually in a state of some degree of despair because they are so worried about what's going to happen to them when they're older, or to their children, or to the world that they're a part of, etc. And so this is partly a kind of opening to say, let's really think about that, let's really talk about that, let's get ourselves in a position where in a few years' time we can get something like this through, or where we can get something better than this through, or where we can get something which is perhaps more modest than this through quite quickly, whatever it might be. But there's got to be a direction of travel here and a debate which we can and must participate in.
Right, I think what we might have to do at this point, I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hands up. And I think this would have to be the last round, and we'll probably have to take these together so that we finish by at least 5-2 for people who need to buttonhole anybody else. So that's these five. Can you keep your hands up for a second, and we'll... That's become six now. 1, 2... There's one in the back row who hasn't spoken. 3... Jonathan, and 5. I don't think we'll manage the others. We'll see if we can still manage that. Can we do that in that sequence, please? As short as possible, and don't forget to tell us who you are.
Thank you very much. Dave Hatton, Carbon Coach and Marlowe FM Radio. Rupert, you're a philosopher, and I want to go slightly psychological on you, if I may. But when a group of people gather together and start looking for someone else to have a veto on something, that's sometimes us externalising our power to say no. And I just wonder what it is every single one of us in this room is not prepared to say no to.
Okay.
In your preamble, Rupert, you said something about short-termism, and I seem to remember you talking about short-termism in the boardroom. And I'm wondering how this might impact the boardroom.
And in the back row, please.
I was going to say that fuel property directive is happening in Europe at the moment. Which I would think is something that future generations might consider very helpful, bearing in mind that it would stop the importation of fertilizers into Europe and thereby not help escalate burning of Canadian fertilizers into something James Hansen has said would need to get over to the climate. It's a shame that Norman Baker isn't here so we could all discuss demographics and maybe stand up and change it. Decision to suffer this very sensible legislation that's going through the European Union. And not only that, but to talk to other countries and try and also get them on the UK's side as well. There is a tie in with the discussion today, which is that kind of meddling represents another kind of level, really, not just existing legislation or potential legislation, but active government policy. Could the Future Generations Council say something about the UK talking to other European partners, encouraging kind of damaging policy?
Okay, Jonathan?
Yes.
Can you tell everybody who you are?
Jonathan, as the Green Council by Rachel. Two points. One, in response to Rupert's point about the state of despair, and I hope that alliance or love for future generations as an alternative to simply climate justice today might widen and increase our passion and responsiveness to the real urgency for some of these issues. And my position is I came back from Bangladesh, so I feel like I've come back from the future away. And in a sense that those countries will be impacted by what we do sooner than our future generations here. So in some sense, is the old adage, think global, act local, that may be a way in which you think you're putting that into practice today, because it's the global communities that are affected by what we do here today. And now, and maybe if we move from that veto idea to maybe positive ideas, which was mentioned by the chapter on eco-cycle, maybe we should be asking those in the vulnerable, most vulnerable nations who are forming a new pact to move away from China versus America in global climate change debates, we should be asking those countries to be represented and maybe writing a roadmap for a green economy for the UK on our part, so they can use their effective veto today in this parliament now. And I'm wondering if some of the best philosophical implemented today, think taking on board some global climate change perspectives and really deal with this conflict.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Charlotte Fischler. I'm here for the World Association for Girl Guides. So we have 10 million girls and young women around the world working to make a better world. So you can imagine this goes down very well. The movement. But rather than saying all the great things that I've provided, I would like to raise one criticism. And one thing that has been mentioned before as well, what for me is not so wonderful is the fact that they have nuclear power, so they say no to things. And I would suggest that maybe another way to approach it would be to set up a set of criteria of that every law or every regulation would have to be measured against us in order to make it future-proof. And I like an expression of future-proof very much. But then again, I also think that the set of criteria would have to be reviewed constantly, because in a way it also has to be foolproof. Such as that the people who are setting out these criteria don't necessarily know best, or know best at the time, but it might change over time. And there is that saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So even if we think that is the best for our future generations now, it might change, or it might turn out that was probably not the best idea. So that's the other thing I wanted to raise, is how do we know that that's the right thing? How would we know that that is the right thing for our future generation? And also, when it is, for example, different levels, like national and regional and global, who is righter? Or who knows better? So these are my thoughts.
Okay, thank you very much. There's a degree of overlap, and you've got 5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes. I thought you were going to say 2 minutes. Okay, great. Okay, thanks so much. Great questions. I think we've had a great discussion throughout. I hope it'll go on when we break up into an informal mode in a few minutes' time. I'll start with Jonathan's question, which might be a sort of planted question. I don't know, Jonathan, because, of course, as you will know, but not everyone in the room will know, I've got a piece on the Greenhouse website, which you're all welcome to go and read, about precisely how we should think about the future and climate and so on in terms drawn from ideas of love and care and so on, rather more than of justice, which is the expression that we're taught we should think about these things in terms of. So if you're interested in this, do go and read that piece, and I agree with what Jonathan said. The tar sands question is a great question. I agree with your criticisms of Norman Baker's recent actions on that. It's clearly the kind of issue that would be relevant to the Guardians. It's clearly the kind of thing that that they would have a concern about, and I think it's the kind of issue where we might hope that a future-proofing mechanism such as the Guardians would result in a better outcome than what the outcome we look like we're getting under the current political system. That raises the question, I think, of the veto power. Several people have brought up, why a veto power? Well, I think the first thing to say about this is that a jury that is picked from ordinary people, you don't want to lay too much on them by way of saying something like, you have to come up with the solutions. I think it actually makes more sense in the first place to say something like, okay, the governments are about trying to do the right thing, and we elect the government, etc., etc., but maybe the first thing and the most powerful thing that you can do is say no to some things that the government are wanting to do if they're not good enough. That wouldn't, of course, be an end of the matter. The government would then try doing things in another way or whatever. I discuss some of this in the report. Now, in terms of positive powers, I've already mentioned that the Guardians could be given a positive power to initiate legislation, and I think this would be a really good idea and would answer some of the concerns in the room about, well, we don't want to make them all negative, do we? One example might be the example that you brought up, Ben. So short-termism in the boardroom. What would be the Guardian's attitude towards this? Well, I think one thing that they might well think is something like, there's a real problem here. There's a serious problem here. This is one of the most obvious areas where our economic system, our business system, is completely failing future people. And they might, for example, initiate some legislation which would alter company law to require companies not to be so short-termist, or, as people have argued previously, to allow for the revocation of companies' licenses to be in business if they practiced certain forms of behavior which were extremely socially unbeneficial, for example, towards future generations. So absolutely, I think this is the kind of thing that we should be thinking about and that the Guardians would think about. And finally, to the question of, well, what about potentially substituting for the Guardians? This is how I heard your question. Maybe I'm not hearing it right. some kind of criteria for what laws would have to pass. The reason I don't think that's such a good proposal, although I can certainly see a role for such criteria, is I think that would be perceived as an attempted kind of constitutional entrenchment, which was doing a kind of end run around democracy. And what I'm trying to suggest here is actually we need to find a way of rethinking democracy and enabling people to think, look, democracy can work through election and through the democratic mechanisms that we're used to, or it can work through sortition, and perhaps a sortitional solution would be a better solution as a route towards creating what we really want to have, a genuinely deliberative democracy in a country like this, than a solution where you try to say, well, we as some kind of constitutional arbiters are going to prohibit in advance the passing of certain kinds of laws according to the following criteria. I think it would be extremely difficult ever to get such a constitutional change through, and I think it wouldn't be actually as empowering or perceived of as being as democratic as the Guardians could potentially be were they to be understood in the way which I'm urging that they should be understood.
Thank you very much, Rupert. I'm afraid we've run out of time. If you have a look in the report itself, you'll find a draft of the oath for the Guardians.
Shall we all stand up and read it?
Well, that was one suggestion. I don't think we quite have the time. But what I would suggest is that maybe if you go home and read it through aloud, then the feel of that might give you a sense of how this institution might well work.
Be a Guardian.
But before we all break up then, can I ask you to join me in thanking everybody who contributed today, both yourselves and then our speakers, Niccolo, Peter, Rupert, of course, our three parliamentarians, and especially Caroline for hosting the event. And thank you all very much. Read the report and spread it around.
Most of the way from Trafalgar Square. Okay. Do you want to make a brief announcement?
I can agree.
Far away.
One last announcement, a very relevant one.
Those here gathered may like to know that Green Drinks, lovely London-wide Green Drinks, is going on right now at Walkers of Whitehall, which is a pub on the eastern side of Whitehall near Trafalgar Square. I'll be going there. I'm sure some others will be too.
I will be too.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.